Hello and welcome to another Trev and Ben podcast.
Hello.
Hello Ben, how are you?
I'm not bad, how are you?
I'm alright. I had a little bit of a weird thing happen to me on my way over to you today. Not a weird thing, it was just one of those tall tales that you're told by someone trying to scam you out of a bit of money.
Oh right, you really can't seem to get to my house without something happening to you.
So basically I needed to fill up with petrol on the way.
Okay.
So stopped off and filling up the car. And this guy comes over to me, and you know what it's like when you just feel that body coming towards you. You think, what do you want?
Yeah.
And he was like, he was an Irish guy, and he was like, excuse me, sir.
Is that an accent we're allowed to do?
I think we can do Irish.
Okay.
I think that's all right, isn't it?
Too late now. It's done.
Excuse me, sir. And I said yes. And I think I had that weary look in my eye. It was like, oh, what do you want? He went, I'm really sorry to bother you, sir, but I've had a bit of a row with the old wife this morning, and my van's been seized. My own fault, because I didn't have any insurance on it.
Right. What's that got to do with his wife?
Well, apparently, she buggered off on a train to somewhere. It didn't tell me where the wife had gone, but she'd obviously stormed off once this van, this alleged van, had been seized by the police. She'd gone off with his phone, apparently.
Right.
And on his phone was his bank card. I don't know. I mean, I know you can pay for stuff, you know, on your phone now, but he said my bank card's on the phone.
I don't really understand that, unless maybe he's got one of those phones with a case with you can put your bank card
slip in. Quite possibly, but he had a wallet. He took his wallet out. I think he wanted to show me ID or whatever.
Right.
He said, I've been asking for 2 hours. Any chance you can spare some change for me to get on the train? No. How many stories have I heard over the years that are like this? Do you know what I mean? Someone's got to get a train or a bus to somewhere. Just absolute nonsense. You're not getting any cash out of me.
I had a strange thing similar to that in Croydon when I was working. I had someone approach me and she said, oh, I'm really sorry to bother you. I need to get some money for the train because I've just been hit by a tram.
Right.
And I sort of said, oh, are you okay?
Call 999.
I didn't really understand how the two things were connected.
No.
Like, did the tram knock all the money out of your pocket and now you haven't got any? Why does that mean that you need money for a train?
Yeah, I don't understand the amount of times I've been stopped by people who need money for a train or a bus because something has happened to them.
Yeah.
Something extraordinary has happened to them. And you think, this never happens to me. I've never found myself in a situation where I've had to be going around saying, I need money for a train. Look, if somebody I felt was genuinely in need,
yeah,
of course I would help, because I used to be quite, I suppose, naive. I used to end up giving quite a bit of money to these people. I always believed it, and it took me quite a long time to sort of cotton on to this scam, and because I just used to feel sorry for people. I was like, yeah, of course. And I think the thing that tipped me over the edge once was some guy come up to me. He's like, oh, you know, I've found whatever the story was. He had to get to the hospital. I mean, they're often having to get to the hospital.
Yes.
You know, somebody's in hospital. So it's like, oh, somebody's in the hospital. Could you give me £1 for the bus fare?
Mm.
So at that point, it's like, okay, yeah, of course, mate, give him the £1. And then he says to me, I mean, any chance of another £1? And I just said to him, but you've just asked me for £1 to get on the bus. I've given you that £1.
Yeah.
That has now paid for the bus fare, according to you, of where you need to get to. So, no.
Too right. And the smart ass in me would have wanted to point out that the buses don't take cash anymore.
I think this was before the days
of
the Oyster card. I think it was before that. So anyway, I don't know quite how I've come across this morning.
I think you've come across well, actually. I think you've done the right thing.
Excellent. Well, good. Right, coming up in this week's podcast, I've had a week of self-discovery.
Have you?
Found out quite a lot about myself this week. Well, I say quite a lot. Still a lot of questions to be answered.
Well, this sounds intriguing.
From the stuff I've found out. And also, we're going to be talking a lot about physics stuff.
I look forward to that.
So I found out a lot about myself in the last week.
How?
Well, two things. First of all, I don't know if you remember on the podcast, I think it was last week, I mentioned that every time I come here, something goes wrong with my car.
Yes.
And the seat had gone sort of haywire the last time I was here.
Yeah.
Where it had sort of, well, it collapsed on me.
Yeah.
I'd fallen backwards.
Sounds incredibly dangerous.
And then the seat wouldn't come back into its rightful position. It was sort of at a very odd angle.
Mm.
So driving felt very dangerous.
I can imagine.
So it took a little bit of finding, but I found a replacement seat.
Oh, you did?
And at £25 on eBay.
Very reasonable.
Very good, isn't it? I had to do a little bit of a jaunt to go and get it.
Okay.
But the guy put it in for me. It's lovely, right?
Nice.
But the question was asked, because one side of the chair was so out of kilter with where it should be.
Yeah.
He said to me, do you lead in a particular direction when you're driving? And I said, I don't think so.
I've never even considered if I'm leaning when I'm driving.
This is the thing. I've not considered it before, but since the new seat's gone in, I realised that I lean quite heavily to my left when I'm driving, which has obviously put more strain on that side of the seat, which obviously didn't help its positioning.
And that's the side that's given way.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I've really noticed it because I sort of, in the new seat, sit down and there's definitely more pressure on that side of my shoulder than there is on the other side. So I lean to one side. And as I'm getting older, you know, a lot of old people lean forward.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to end up leaning to the left. I'm sort of just going to curl around. I'm going to eventually look like I'll only be able to do the C in YMCA when I get older, because I'm always going to be leaning across that way. I'm not going to be able to get into any other position. The Y is going to be no good. The M, not a chance. I'm there.
So by the time you're 80 years old, you'll be sort of walking around looking constantly over your shoulder.
I think I'll be like an N by the time I'm about 80.
Wow.
So I didn't know that. I didn't know I leant in a particular direction.
Okay, well, I'm gonna try that for myself.
Yeah, find out if you lean in a particular, if this is a natural thing, or whether I need to worry that it's a medical condition, that my skeleton is gradually leaning to one side.
That is a concern.
So yeah, so I found that out about myself, because that's a bit weird. But more importantly than that, I found out about where I come from.
Okay.
So I've done one of these ancestry DNA tests.
Oh, that sounds exciting.
So I was a little bit cynical about them. I got it for Christmas, and I've only just got around to doing it.
Yeah.
Turns out I'm really dull.
Oh, really?
Really dull. I was sort of hoping it was going to come back and say, I don't know, I was like an eighth Nigerian or something. Do you know what I mean? Like something really interesting.
That would have been good.
Wow, I don't wonder what that is. And this is what I've got back from it, right? So my ethnicity estimate, England, Wales and Northern Europe, 90%.
Quite strong.
It says possibly more from the southeast England, Surrey and Sussex. Well, that's right. I mean, I've grown up in Surrey,
yeah.
If you can call Croydon Surrey, it does. My postal address does say Surrey.
Yeah, but surely just because you've grown up there will have no impact on your DNA, though, will it?
Well, no, but I suppose my family have all grown up. You know, that's where my roots are. Devon and Cornwall. There's a bit of that there.
Oh,
which is weird because I mean I wouldn't say I've got a particularly strong accent in any way, shape, or form. Probably more London, but you know, I'm not proper London, not Cockney, am I?
No, you're not. At all.
He's up my brain. I'm not one of them.
No, you're not.
Do you know what I mean? I'd like to be.
Thankfully.
No, I'd like to be, because there's a cheerfulness about those people, isn't there?
I think so.
And I think it's all about the amount you open your mouth.
Do you?
I do. I do, because I think if you're proper Cockney, your mouth opens incredibly wide. Everything you do has got a wide mouth. What? What? And your mouth opens really. What, mate? What? Whereas, you know, if you're posh, you tend not to open your mouth at all.
You might be onto something with that.
You know,
so poshness is directly linked to mouth openness.
Yeah, and then regional stuff as well. You know, I think if you're proper Cockney within the bells of Bow or whatever it is.
You've lost me. I don't know what you're talking about anymore.
Then I reckon because you have to probably shout over the sound of the bells, your mouth.
I don't think
opens.
Anyone knows what you're talking about anymore.
Okay, well, move on. But anyway, the point I was going to make was people have said to me in the past, oh, I can't quite place your accent. Is it Cornish? No, it's not.
Oh.
But it's interestingly, there is a bit of Cornishman in me. 7% of me is Norwegian.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I suppose I'm Anglo-Saxon, so it's not a massive surprise that there's a sort of Scandinavian root, but Norwegian. I'd like to find out a bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of the opposite, really, to my wife. She got one of these done, and she came back as only 1% British.
Really?
Largely Scandinavian.
Did you know you were marrying a foreigner?
I didn't.
No. Have you checked her credentials? Should she be here?
Well, who knows?
Post-Brexit, I hope she's shipped out.
Oh dear.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. So what, are you linked to anyone interesting, anyone famous?
I don't know. I just finally, the 3% Irish and Scottish. So I feel a bit bad having to go at that bloke earlier. It's probably some long lost cousin. I thought I should have helped him out. I'm sorry. Yes. Oh, long lost family. I should have done that.
Yeah.
Well, the weird thing is, on the website I've done this with, it does give you quite a lot. For me, 200 odd people I might be related to. But I find that a bit weird. I don't like this thing of, here's someone that you might be related to. Wow. And they could be your second, third, fourth, fifth cousin. It's like, I'm not going to be getting in touch with them, am I?
You never know when you might need an organ.
Yeah, but I think the further away you are related, the less likely it is you're going to... I suppose it's more likely to match than just a stranger.
True.
Good point. I need to be cultivating these people, just get them into... corral them.
Yeah.
Sort of put them in a barn, essentially, and just make them my replacement organs.
Yeah, or bone marrow. You never know. They could have all sorts of uses, these people.
They could... I'd never thought that this could be my gateway to eternal life. Like, I could continually just sort of... I'd be like Doctor Who, just regenerate.
Yeah.
Like, phone up... I mean, look, I'm not going to say any names, like, full names, because that would be unfair.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if I was to get in touch with Mr. Snell, for example, who is supposedly a second cousin to me, if I was to phone him up and say, hey, Mr. Snell, we're related. I could deal with a new kidney.
Or spine. your twisting problem.
Maybe this is the thing. I'll phone up and say, hello, Mr. Snell. I hope you don't mind me calling. I just wonder, do you lean to the left at all?
Yeah.
And just find out, you know, if that's like a family trait.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Like, all me and my family, we're all slightly bent to the left.
You're all a bit left-leaning.
Yes. So this is, it's fascinating. It's fascinating. You look at all the different people that I could be related to, sort of all over the world. I mean, there are people in Norway that maybe I should get in touch with, because I could do the holiday to Norway. If I was to just turn up on someone's doorstep and say, hey, long lost cuz, I'm here. How do you think that might go down well?
You never know until you try. I wouldn't recommend it, but you never know.
Are there any famous Norwegians?
Famous Norwegians. Is Alexander Skarsgård Norwegian, or is he Swiss?
No, he's not Swiss.
Swedish?
Swedish, possibly. Mm. Or Danish. He's more likely to be Swedish or Danish.
Come on, we must be able to name one famous Norwegian.
I can't think of any off the top of my head. Wasn't there a Norwegian explorer? Anderson, whoever it was who got to the North or South Pole. What are the polar explorers?
That's no good if we can't name them.
No.
Who's Klaas Olsen? That shop. Who's that after?
I'd like to be... Oh, no, haven't they gone bust?
Oh, have they?
Because I was going to say maybe that's where I could inherit my millions. I'm Trevor Klaas Olsen Smith.
Yeah.
Now, Ben, you know that I've been going to the Croydon Astronomical Society.
Yes, how's that going?
I've only been to one, actually, so far.
Oh.
But it was fascinating stuff, right? It was on gravitational waves, which was exciting. But it's got me thinking a lot about space and the Earth and all that sort of thing.
Right? Okay.
And we were having a chat the other day, weren't we, about shooting stars.
Yeah.
You said to me, it's very rare to see a shooting star.
Yeah, I thought so.
And I said, well, they're not that rare, because it's sort of things that are burning up as they enter our atmosphere.
Yeah, but it's such a fleeting thing to see. They only last such a short amount of time.
But you thought it was the death of a star, didn't you?
I thought that was what a supernova was.
Oh, that's what supernova is, but that's not a shooting star.
I thought it was the same thing.
Well, I don't think so. See, this is the thing, right? You get talking about this stuff, and both of us are throwing things in that could be absolute nonsense.
Yeah.
So I thought we need to get someone in that we can talk to about this stuff and hopefully get some proper answers.
Put us straight, okay.
Put us straight. And also educate a couple of buffoons. So our guest this week is Gareth Sturgeon. Now, he's a teacher of sort of many subjects, but physics is his big thing, and he knows quite a lot about space and astronomy and astronomical things. Hello, Gareth.
Hello, Trev. Hello, Ben.
Hello.
Thanks very much for joining us on the Trev and Ben podcast. Let's start with the answer to the thing we've just been talking about, shooting stars then. So, I'm guessing I'm right.
Well, as much as it grieves me to say, on this occasion, you are right.
Ben
is wrong in this case. So a shooting star isn't actually a star.
What?
Stars are much, much bigger than Earth, right? So if there was a star sort of falling through the Earth's atmosphere, we wouldn't know anything about it because we'd be destroyed. A shooting star is actually a tiny particle of material. A big one would be like a centimetre across. Usually they're much smaller than that, like a grain of sand size, but they are hitting the gases in our atmosphere at tremendous speed, you know, many hundreds of miles an hour. And at that kind of speed, they burn up with an intense flash of energy, which we see, you know, as a sort of bright track going across the sky. So that's what a shooting star is.
See, I told you.
Well, all right.
I told you.
I'm amazed that I've got to the age of 31 believing that they were shooting stars. Well, it's not really my fault. That's what they're called. Why are they called stars if they're not stars?
Well, because it's a light in the sky, mate. It's an all-encompassing phrase, surely.
So it's a phrase for idiots, then?
It's not a phrase for idiots. Gareth, it's not a phrase for idiots.
If I may intrude on this private argument, in fact, astronomy is full of what we would call misnomers. So words for things that aren't really correct. So, for example, a black hole isn't actually a hole. The Big Bang never went bang. The study of the night sky is full of this kind of stuff. So don't feel too bad about calling it a shooting star. Yeah. It's a lovely poetic image.
The thing is, we'll get onto the Big Bang possibly on another podcast because that's kind of a bigger question. Sure. But I mean, the one thing I would say is, and I'm not questioning your credentials, I'm not questioning science, but what I am saying is, how do we know it didn't go bang? You know, it's like, does a tree make a noise when it's fall down in the wood? Does a tree make a noise when it's chopped?
Whatever it is you're trying to say, I mean, I think we can say that it didn't go bang, because what we mean by bang is a sound wave, and a sound wave is just really a series of high frequency compressions of air. And there definitely was no air around at the moment that we call the Big Bang. So we can categorically say it didn't go bang. Not anything to do with an explosion.
That was the scientific equivalent of a mic drop, wasn't it?
It was.
That was like, Trev, leave it alone.
I feel like I've been misled.
I've never done a mic drop before. I feel suddenly very cool.
Yeah, you could probably get some sort of Nobel Prize for that. It's the Nobel Prize for physics.
In physics, Trev, you have to work a bit harder than that to get a Nobel Prize.
I don't know. I reckon if you were to say, look, I had a mic drop moment on the Trev and Ben podcast, you'd be like, there'll be some German physicist somewhere going, "What? Give him the prize! Give him the Nobel Prize for physics! He deserves it!"
Many of the people that worked on physics at the time of the Second World War, Trev, were fleeing the Nazis. They weren't Nazis themselves. I think you've just done a great disservice to German science.
Well, I don't know. I mean, a lot of them were responsible for space travel. I mean, you know, a lot of Nazis ended up working for NASA.
It is true that that the space program in North America did pull over a load of the Nazi scientists to work on the rocketry and things like that.
That is right.
That much is true.
This podcast has taken a very strange turn that I wasn't expecting.
So, quickly, Ben, ask me another question about the night sky.
I don't know where to begin, really. I mean, I feel like my mind's been blown. Everything I thought was true was a lie.
Well, I've got a question.
Go on.
Ben.
Okay.
This is one that does my head in, right? So the Earth is spinning at something like, what is it? But it's almost like 1,000 miles an hour. Okay,
about 900 miles an hour. Yeah,
900 miles. It's still pretty quick, right? I don't think there's a car yet that's reached that sort of speed. It's a big old It's a big old lump of speed, for want of a better physics phrase.
It's a very technical term.
I'll tell you what. I'll put that in a more scientific bit of language. It is very high velocity. that we are spinning at, right? So we're spinning at 900 miles an hour. Now, I know that obviously that, I suppose that centrifugal force that it's creating helps keep us on the ground with gravity. But I mean, why do we feel that? I mean, that's a hell of a speed. Why do we feel that speed?
Okay, it's a really, really good question, Trev. It sort of opens up a lot of sort of basic ideas. But just to make Ben feel a bit better here, I will say you've just used another thing that doesn't actually exist. You called it centrifugal force.
Yeah.
And for reasons I probably won't go into right now, but centrifugal force is completely fictitious. It doesn't exist.
Wow.
Okay.
There you go. I mean, I might as well just give up now. I mean, what the hell is going on? Mate, I've been lied to all my life.
Stay with me. It's all going to be okay, guys. I promise.
Okay.
Right. What you actually mean is something called centripetal force. But we don't need to get into that. What you're essentially saying is, you know, why don't we feel ourselves going at 900 miles an hour? This is something that Einstein thought a great deal about.
Another German. Not
exactly. another German, but we're moving on from his nationality. He thought a lot about this, but not quite that question, but it's in the same sort of area that he was thinking about. Basically, Einstein's great insight was that if you and everything around you is moving at the same speed, so everything you're sort of in contact with, everything that forms the frame of reference, if you like, around you, if that's all traveling at the same speed, then you won't notice that.
Oh, you won't notice.
The only way you can tell when you're going at a speed is if there is another frame of reference to compare yours with. So you look outside a train window, and you can see that, you know, the countryside around you is, to all intents and purposes, stationary, and you're moving through it. That's how you know you're moving. But what we're saying with the Earth is the countryside and everything else is moving at the same speed because it's all part of the Earth. So you don't notice it.
So basically, right, okay, because here's what I'm thinking.
Okay.
But I think I've just answered my own question in my head. I'll do it out loud, seeing as it's a podcast.
Go on.
So basically, what I was saying was if the countryside was moving at 900 miles an hour, but I'm on a train that's moving at 125 miles an hour, but that's 125 miles an hour on top of the 900 miles
Correct.
An hour. Right.
Okay,
Correct.
So the thing I was always confused about as a child, and I think it's sort of the same answer, is if you're in a moving train and you're at the end of the carriage and you jump up in the air.
Yeah, I mean, if you're on a moving train, you're not in London. I mean, that's
but if you're on a fast moving train and you're inside
the
carriage.
And you certainly can't jump up in the air. But anyway, yes.
And you jump while you're in the carriage. Why is it you don't shoot to the other end of the carriage? But that's because you're moving with it, aren't you?
Correct. So you've launched yourself, as it were, from the floor of the train, which as you're jumping up in the air is also moving forward. Now, if you were able to stay up in the air for longer than the fraction of a second that you spend when you jump, if you could spend longer, you would find yourself further down the train because the train will have moved beneath you temporarily. For the time you're in the air, you know, you're not connected to the train.
Right.
So the train would move forward underneath you. But of course, we can't jump for several seconds. We can only jump for a fraction of a second. So you don't really notice that effect.
Well, here's another travel-based question. You didn't realise that this was going to become sort of a transport-based podcast.
Well, I mean, physics is good at answering questions for all of life, so go for it.
Because there's a theory that when you travel by plane, the plane could just rise vertically and just wait for the Earth to spin and then land again at where you need to be. I mean, obviously, you know, there are you might need to move the plane because the Earth moves, you know, you're not necessarily going to be over the country you need to be in. But, I mean, why does it have to fly the whole way? Couldn't it just hover for most of it?
So that's another... I'm really impressed with the quality of your questions, I have to say. I mean, essentially, the issue is the Earth is moving at around 900 miles an hour, so... you have to kind of think about being stationary while the Earth moves at that speed. That's a very big difference in speeds, okay? But more than that, you can't leave the ground unless you are moving, okay? Because of the way that forces and gravity is working, you've got to keep moving in some way to defy those forces. And so you can't just lift yourself off the surface of the Earth and wait for it to move beneath you. However, related to this, are the satellites in the sky that are powering sort of mobile phones and GPS and all of that. They move at precisely the speed of the Earth. So relative to the Earth, they appear to be stationary, which is why your mobile phone can always find them when it sends out its signal into space. It knows exactly where it is because it's moving at the speed of the Earth. So it's essentially stationary compared to the Earth.
Wow. I mean, this is all mind-blowing.
It is.
Stuff. Are you keeping up, Ben?
That's why I've got a bit quiet. Really, I'm sort of sitting here thinking.
Just watching your face drop as we're talking. Well, here's another question that Ben came up with the other day when we were having a chat about this on the phone. Because, you know, when Ben and I speak on the phone, we do have very intellectual conversations.
I can tell. Yes, I can tell.
So he said to me, well, Ben, explain what you're saying to me about your theory of you're looking back in time.
Yeah, this is to do with if you had a powerful enough telescope and you were far enough away, because of the amount of time it takes light to travel, you could be on another planet miles away with a very strong telescope. And when you look at Earth, you actually could potentially see something like World War II as it unfolded, because you're seeing the light from years ago reaching the telescope. Is that right?
Ben, when you're, I mean, your questions are few and far between, but when they come out, you know, they're real, they're bullet-like questions.
I should point out that most of Ben's knowledge is either from video games or cartoons. So which video game or cartoon did this idea come from, Ben?
I honestly can't remember.
It must have been The Simpsons. It's always The Simpsons.
Probably.
Well, you know that The Simpsons was put together by a mathematician, right? I think Matt Groening, but some of the other guys as well involved, were sort of maths graduates or something like that. Simon Singh's written a brilliant book about the mathematics of The Simpsons. You should read it.
Wow.
There's loads of sort of maths gags and, you know, really high level mathematics packed into The Simpsons. It's fascinating.
I'm suddenly feeling a lot more intelligent now.
I don't think you're intelligent just because you watched The Simpsons. You didn't know any of this until just now. So don't lord it over me with this I'm intelligent laugh.
No, okay. So that is technically true, though, what I've said, isn't it?
Yeah, so let's get into that, because that's a really important observation. So the nearest star to Earth is what we call 4 light years away. That star is known as Proxima Centauri. You might have heard of Alpha Centauri, but the nearest star to Earth is Proxima Centauri. That star is 4 light years away. So to get at what Ben's talking about, we have to think about light traveling through space. So, you know, think of light rays traveling through space, but they go at a fixed speed. Right, they're not just an infinite speed. They go at 300 million meters every second, which is really, really fast. And as it happens, nothing else in the universe can travel as fast as light. But anyway, it's got a fixed speed. So if you are more than 300 million meters away from something, then light is going to travel more than a second to reach you. Well, the nearest star, Proxima Centauri, the light from that takes 4 years to get to Earth. Now, just think about that. 4 years traveling at 300 million meters every second.
Wow.
Of those 4 years. So when we look into the sky and we see Proxima Centauri, we're actually seeing it. Those light rays left Proxima Centauri, that star, 4 years ago. So we see it 4 years ago.
Wow.
We are effectively looking at that star as it was 4 years ago. Now, if that's sort of blowing your mind a bit too much, think about the sun. It takes light 8 minutes to reach the Earth from the sun. So when we look up in the sky and see the sun, we're actually seeing it 8 minutes ago.
Wow. So I'm going to ask a question which could sound potentially very, very stupid.
Go on, ask it. Go on.
I don't mind.
They're my favourite questions.
If there was an alien on a faraway planet that had technology to fire weapons faster than the speed of light and hit Earth,
yep,
that means that they could do that and technically change the past as we know it and change the complete current modern day situation we're all living in the blink of an eye.
But also, hang on, if they're going faster than light, if they've got a weapon that's going faster than light, they could potentially almost be hitting us in the future.
Oh, now you've blown my mind. How can that happen?
Well, if you go faster than light, that means potentially you're in the future, doesn't it?
Oh, now you've blown my mind again.
If I can bring some science to this discussion.
Oh, you're going to ruin it with science. Here we go.
But I mean, this is exactly what Einstein's revolution in our understanding of the universe was all about. Okay, because Einstein managed to figure out that the speed of light, it's the speed that light goes at, but that speed, 300 million meters per second, turns out to be absolutely fundamental to the structure of the universe itself. So rather than thinking of it as the speed of light, it would be better to just think of it as the speed, the ultimate speed. And that is crucial to the way that the universe is sort of put together, as it were. And for that reason, things can't go faster than that, because to go faster than that, it would literally mean the universe as we understand it could not function.
So the alien with the big gun, if he's living in our universe, could never possess the technology to fire a gun with bullets faster than the speed of light.
Correct. Okay. Absolutely correct. There was a few years ago now, probably 2 or 3 years ago, you may have seen in the headlines that some Italian scientists thought that they'd caused particles to accelerate faster than the speed of light. And this caused, obviously, a huge furore in the world of high-energy physics, because that just isn't supposed to be able to happen. And it turns out that it hadn't happened. You know, if that result had come through, we would literally have to revise all our understanding of modern physics. Thankfully, it didn't turn out to be true, and physics as we know it is fairly safe. But you're right, Ben, an alien, nobody could fire something through our universe at faster than that ultimate speed of 300 million meters a second.
So if you think that that's what light travels at, so if you think that like an alien might be just getting the 1966 World Cup right now.
Yeah,
let's say.
Yeah.
So, the sound is obviously that moves slower than light. So we could, yeah, this podcast, I mean, you and I are probably dead.
Great.
I mean, sorry to bring a bit of death into it, but you and I are probably dead. But an alien might just be hearing this right now and thinking, God, it was the Germans. They're the ones that sorted it all out. You know, they'll be learning from this podcast. Because this was weird, Gareth. A few years back, right, I went to see the launch of the space shuttle. Yeah. And the nearest you can get is about 12 miles away. So it's a fair, yeah, distance. And I'm not the brightest man in the world, but I also like to think that, you know, I've got some intelligence. You may have changed your mind having spoken to us for the last 20 minutes or so. but the weird thing was, I didn't even consider the lag between seeing the space shuttle go and the noise hitting you. So the thing launched, and I was expecting the sound straight away. And it was just really weird, because you watch this thing go, and obviously the light is traveling faster, so you see it. And then it took about 50, I think it was about 52 seconds or whatever for it to get. And then, I mean, the noise is incredible when you see the shuttle launch. It's just absolutely insane. But it's a weird phenomenon when you don't think about it. It wasn't even in my mindset. It's like, well, where's the noise? Where's this? Oh, there it is.
I'm so jealous of you being able to watch the shuttle go up. I mean, I would have loved to have seen that. But, you know, this, the same effect is in every thunderstorm. In every thunderstorm you've ever known, the lightning that, yeah, you see and the thunder that you hear are at the same moment. The thunder and lightning are two sides of one event, but you see the lightning always before you hear the thunder, because the lightning is traveling with the speed of light, but the thunder is traveling a million times slower at the speed of sound.
So what's the speed of sound-ish?
The speed of sound is about 330 meters every second, so essentially about a million times slower than light.
Because there's a weird thing, I don't know whether you were taught this as a kid, and I still do it now, even as a 42-year-old, I still do it. You see the flash of lightning, and then you count. And I was always told that almost tells you how many miles away it is. You know, if it's 5 seconds between you, the flash of lightning and the thunder, oh, it's about 5 miles away. And I was terrified of storms as a kid. And that used to reassure me that it's not right overhead. And, you know, I was across the road from a tree being struck once. It's the most terrifying thing that I've ever experienced.
Yeah, I mean, lightning is such a fascinating thing. Perhaps one of the most extraordinary things about lightning is that when it strikes a patch of ground, depending on the sort of soil you've got there, if the ground is of a particular type of sand, then the lightning is like a sort of channel of light. It's like a kind of, if you imagine sort of drilling into the sand, that's what the lightning is doing through the air and then into the ground. And if you have the right kind of soil, it can turn that channel, the sand that's in that channel, into a sort of glassy substance. They're called fulgurites.
Wow.
And you can dig these things up, and they are many, many meters long. I think, if I'm correct, the longest fulgurite ever found so far was like tens of meters long, you know. And they look like these strange kind of worm-like sort of structures, and it is literally where the lightning has buried its way into the ground, and there's a sort of path of charge. It's melted the sand into glass, and you get these incredible structures.
Are they considered valuable?
They're really valuable. In fact, they're very delicate as well. So sort of digging one out and then kind of keeping it intact requires an awful lot of work. So these things are highly, highly prized. I mean, you can get them of various lengths. But some enterprising company in the States, I think, has developed these wonderful things. You should look for them on the internet. They're beautiful things to have. A sort of glass, a plastic block. I think it's something, some kind of acetate or something like that. But it's like a see-through plastic block. And they make a small point of charge on the top of this block, just like lightning, but on a much, much smaller scale, obviously. But this is exactly how sort of lightning hits the earth. They make a charge. And so the patterns of charge spread out like branches of a tree, or sort of nerve endings in the human body. It spreads out through the plastic, but it's there sort of kept for all time, and wow, you can see it. So they act, first of all, as a really good sort of model of what fulgurites look like under the earth that we hardly ever see, but also these incredible, so they're very aesthetic structures, you know, and the similarity with say, a tree, is really dramatic, and it's a really good introduction to sort of what lightning is actually like. It's fascinating.
Well, two things I want to say there. One is, it's like when you see people that have survived being struck by lightning and the marks left on their body, it's like that, isn't it? You see like the kind of the marks, it's like a tree, the roots of a tree and the branches all on the body. That's terrifying. The second thing I want to say is that within all of this scientific talk, Ben was straight there with, are they valuable? What, can I make money? What can I do with it? I mean, Ben, just the natural wonder of it. It's like, no, I want to make money out of it.
It just sounded amazing.
Well, Ben, if Ben looking to make money out of lightning, where he should go, the place to that you're most likely to get struck by lightning is if you play golf in Florida on a Sunday. That's statistically the most likely place you are to get struck by lightning. And of course, it's because there happen to be a lot of storms in that part of the world. In August, the air is just at the right kind of temperature to generate storms. And if you're playing golf, you're holding a small piece of metal in the air, you know, which is perfect conditions for getting struck by lightning. But here's the really important thing. You can get superpowers if you're struck by lightning. Okay, now I don't want to...
Hang on. We built you up as a scientist, and now what's coming out of your mouth?
Well, yeah, wait and see, because this one really... I mean, in some sense...
I think this was a Channel 4 show, Misfits, wasn't it? I saw that, yeah.
Well, look, listen to this. This is incredible. Okay, so some people that have been struck by lightning, and I don't want to minimise... how traumatic that is. You know, people can obviously be killed in that way, and anyone that's undergone that kind of experience, it's a terrifying, deeply, deeply traumatic experience. But some people have found that they can see ultraviolet light post a lightning strike. So literally where we, you know, those scanners in, say, for example, in a supermarket, you know, the self-service scanners, they're often working with ultraviolet light. It's ultraviolet light that's reading the barcode. We can't see that because we don't see that part of the spectrum of light. The only time we see ultraviolet light is if you maybe go into a, you know, a nightclub or something where they're using ultraviolet light and people's white T-shirts glow in a kind of quite ethereal way. I'm sure you all familiar with that, but we can't actually see ultraviolet light itself. People that has been struck by lightning can. Wow. And that's an amazing effect that lightning has on the human brain. Ultraviolet light is often how things like birds of prey spot their prey on the ground. So, you know, once you've been struck by lightning, if you live, don a cape and you can become the next superhero. You heard it here first.
I mean, it enables you to catch rabbits unaware.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an amazing superpower to have. Does it make you magnetic?
It doesn't, as far as I'm aware.
What about those people that can have spoons put on them? Is that a weird phenomenon?
I think they're generally... a bit mad.
Right, mad and fraudulent.
So we've talked about the effect of...
I think that's probably it.
So we know about the effect of lightning hitting the Earth and the amazingly valuable things it creates, the weird things that can happen if it hit humans, but I've always had this nagging want to know, why when it hits the sea, don't we get thousands of dead fish if water conducts electricity?
That's another brilliant question. Ben, the thing is, when we see lightning, what's happening is that a large buildup of charge in the atmosphere is discharging through the Earth. So when you you might have done this at school or something, been really annoying. If you find a particular type of carpet, you rub your feet on the carpet and you can give someone an electric shock.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's basically the charge just jumping from your finger to them. And you both actually get the shock, but you know it's coming. So, your victim doesn't. Really exactly the same principles going on with lightning on a massive, massive scale. Now, you know, you have to make your finger, or you have to sort of, you know, sometimes do it with your knuckle. In other words, you have to have some kind of point for that charge to discharge from. That's why it's unsafe to stand under a tree in lightning and so on, because lightning needs some kind of point to discharge on. Tall buildings, church spires, they always have lightning conductors. Yes. Because they're a sort of pointy thing. So you're very unlikely to get lightning discharging at sea, because there's no point. So obviously, you can discharge on the mast of a ship or something like that. And that's why living near the coast, you often see these storm effects, because as the storm clouds drift over onto the Earth, suddenly they encounter lots of sort of upright structures and they can discharge. And here's another thing that you probably don't realize is true, that a lot of the time the lightning isn't going from the clouds to the Earth, it's going from the Earth to the clouds. It's actually in the opposite direction to the traditional way of thinking about lightning. So that's yet another thing that just ruins everything you thought was true.
Wow, hang on. Yes, that's done my mind in.
So lightning's going from the Earth to
the clouds. It's going up.
Very often it's going up, yeah.
So when you get struck by lightning, you're not actually being struck, it's just working its way through your body and out your body.
Well, there are two different types of strike, and sometimes it's coming from the sky downwards, other times it's going from the Earth upwards. But when you're being struck by lightning, the effect will be the same no matter which way that flow of charge is going.
All I know is it's bloody powerful, because when I was opposite, I was about 6 years old, and I was at my aunt and uncle's house, and there was a big old storm, and I was terrified, and I used to sit under the table when there was a storm. But I'd just been getting over my fear of it. You know, when you get to about six and parents sort of say, oh, you know, it's all right, you're not going to get hurt, it's fine. So I was just getting over my fears. So I didn't go under the table this particular day. And then there was just this almighty noise and flash, and the tree over the road had been struck. And I mean, it literally had blown the tree apart. It was terrifying. Ooh. It was charred bits of wood all over the road. I mean, it's a powerful, powerful, scary old thing. And even now, I don't like storms that much. I like to look at them, but there's always this fear.
Victims of lightning strike, if they're wearing jewellery, very often the jewellery will melt against their skin. You know, the big problem with a lightning strike, the terrifying thing, is that it's obviously usually accompanied by vast amounts of rain. So you're very damp, and the real danger of lightning is not so much the charge passing through you, which happens very quickly and is survivable. The real problem is that the water that's covering you and is all in your clothes and so on superheats to steam really quickly. And so there's two effects of that. First of all, the heat from that steam burns you, but secondly, the water turning to water vapor very quickly needs to escape with some force, and you know, if it's trapped inside layers of clothing, then you get some really sort of powerful dramatic forces out of that. And very, very frequently, people have their boots sort of blown off by a lightning strike. Belt buckles can be sort of fired, you know, through your body like a bullet. Really extraordinary thing.
I mean, you've given us some pretty violent reactions that can happen there, but the one I'm really interested in isn't that violent, but does it really make your hair stand on end? I mean, you know, when you see that in the films, you see someone get struck by lightning, their hair always stands on end. I know there's that thing where you do it at school where you hold that thing
I think it's called
the Van de Graaff generator. Is what you're talking about.
That's it. That thing, and then your hair stands on end, and that's the only thing that I remember from my physics lessons at school that I enjoyed.
So here's another sort of an interesting inversion of what we were talking about before. This is something that everyone assumes isn't true, but actually is true. Uh-huh. Okay, so you know I said charges need something sort of pointed to kind of discharge from?
Yeah.
Well, if you think about a strand of hair, that's essentially a very fine but pointy kind of thing.
Yeah.
So what happens is the charge that's going through your body distributes itself all across your body, but when it distributes itself on your hair, all the hairs are sort of repelled from each other through the sort of electrostatic force of this charge. So literally your hairs will stand on end. In a lightning strike, of course, you're so hot. I mean, momentarily, you approach temperatures almost in the region of the surface of the sun.
Wow. How on earth has anyone survived?
This is the amazing thing, isn't it? The human body is really extraordinary. So it turns out that you can put people to enormous temperatures. If you do it for a very short period of time, they might be able to survive it. So frequently, it's not really a case of their hair standing on end, but their hair becomes singed and burnt off. So it's a dramatic thing. But technically speaking, your hair would, stand on end.
I tell you, here's one hidden danger of a thunder and lightning storm that I bet even you don't know, Gareth. This is knowledge I've got.
This will be good.
I'm with you, Ben. This is going to be extraordinary, I'm sure.
Because I like to think that imparting knowledge is a two-way street, and we've learned a lot from you, Gareth, today, but you're going to learn something from me, a bit of a fact about a thunderstorm.
Oh, I've learned an enormous amount about the pair of you this afternoon,
So that day that I was at my aunt and uncle's house and the tree over the road got struck, my aunt, at the moment of the strike, was on the toilet, and she came down and said, "Oh God, what was that? I nearly fell down the loo." So there's a hidden danger of the thunderstorm, is that you could fall down the toilet, get flushed away, and drown. And you never thought of that, did you?
Well, I confess I hadn't. I didn't realise that toilets could get so large that human beings might fall down them.
She was a very small lady.
I mean, that's in itself quite extraordinary, the size she must have been. That's worth reporting to medical science. But here's a thing. I had a dog when I was a kid, and the dog developed a real sensitivity to thunderstorms, and would sort of really shake, go into quite alarming and dramatic trembling. This would be sometimes 45 minutes before the storm would make itself known.
Wow.
And nobody really worked out what that was about, apart from the fact that it turns out to be quite common in animals.
Is it a change of the atmospheric pressure that it's detecting?
I don't know if it was the pressure. My own view is that it was probably the dog's nervous system, because parts of the dog's nervous system are much more highly attuned than a human's, obviously in hearing and things like that, and in smell sense, and I think the dog's nervous system was much more profoundly affected by that sudden build-up in charge than a human being's was, and it made me think maybe this stuff about animals feeling the onset of earthquakes and so on. Maybe there's more to that than meets the eye. My dog certainly knew when a storm was going to happen, and for her it was a terrifying thing, which is, you know, any child will relate to.
Well, there was that extraordinary thing, wasn't there, when the tsunami hit in 2004, the big tsunami.
Didn't all the birds go?
Well, a lot of animals, birds went, but a lot of other land animals were making for high ground before humans were even aware that this tsunami was coming. So, I mean, there is an innate sense in the animals that we've lost that natural sense, I suppose, that intuition.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to intuition, intuition is a thing that is studied by science, but I think there's a lot of grey area there. But what you were saying before about as a child being really terrified by storms, just linking that with what you've just said, I think it's the case that in the modern world we do sometimes forget just how removed we are from nature. And things like a simple thunderstorm, when you take away modern housing and modern lighting and shelter and so on, actually becomes, it doesn't take much for it to become a really terrifying thing. But looking at, you know, going back to what we were talking about at the start of this conversation, something I'm always telling children, increasingly so when I'm teaching them, is that they're losing contact with what the night sky looks like. Mm. The more that we live in bigger cities with lots of electric lighting and so on. And I'm not saying that we should all go back to living in hovels, because cities are really good now at focusing light downwards and not sending streetlights, you know, most of it up into the air and so on, up into the sky. But it's actually quite difficult now to find a really dark site where you can see things like Ben was talking about with shooting stars. It's really difficult to find places where you can see that in all its natural glory. And I think if we lose that completely, that would be a really, really great loss.
We'll leave space there for now, Gareth, but I know you're going to come back on another podcast. We'll talk space again. But as this conversation with you started with reference to a chat that Ben and I had on the phone the other night, which was highly unusual for us when we got talking about intellectual things, rather than just talking about darts or something, which by the way, Ben, I've got you into the darts a little bit. You watched it, didn't you?
It was all right.
Yeah, I told you, it's a good thing. Darts, get into it. But you throw.
Can I just say, if you've brought me onto this show to actually talk about darts, then I have nothing to add. I love it, but I don't know anything about it.
So there'll be some physics that you can attribute to a darts match, though. But we'll get to that another time. But Ben threw this thing at me while we were having this conversation. I thought, well, while we've got you on, we'll clear this up, because he said this line to me and I was like dumbfounded. Just say what you said to me on the phone.
Well, there were two things I said to you. One of them is that gravity isn't an actual law of itself. It's a theory that so far satisfies human testing. And I've heard this, that there's no guarantee that if you were to roll a ball off a table, by the time it should fall, it wouldn't just float. Because gravity isn't a proven law as such.
Well, what about the apple, Newton and all that?
I don't know, but it was just a silly theory.
There's a desk there. Roll something on it. Right? Roll that thing. Roll that pot of stuff on there, right?
Right.
Roll that along the desk. If that floats, I'll eat my hat. Go on.
No, it didn't. But that's not to say it wouldn't have.
What nonsense, Gareth, is he talking now?
Oh, Trev, I'm so sorry, but Ben's really onto something.
Oh, get in. Don't give me all this. You wait till you hear the next one. All right, what do you mean he's onto something?
Well, the thing is that, as we probably all know, Isaac Newton proposed the idea of gravity.
Yeah, apples.
Apples and so on, yeah. What Newton actually proposed was that every object in the universe attracts every other object in the universe to a greater or lesser extent. And he said that depended on how far apart they were and how massive they were. But at bottom level, every object in the universe attracts every other object in the universe. But he did that. Isaac Newton did that for vaguely sort of religious or mystical reasons, and it turns out that that's how the universe seems to be, but we don't really understand why, which is why the Higgs boson, which some people may have heard of.
The God particle.
It's hypothesized as a way of explaining why objects that we see around us in the universe seem to be attracted to each other on this basis. So to bring that Newton's apple in, you know, the story about Newton sitting under his apple tree and the thing falling on his head and he sort of worked out the law of gravity, that's obviously apocryphal.
Yeah.
Although if you go to Newton's house, his cottage in Lincolnshire, there is a beautiful apple tree in the garden, which I strongly encourage anyone to go to and visit that museum. But anyway, what Newton was actually saying was that when he considered an apple falling to Earth, he realized that it was the same principle going on as to why the Earth was, in effect, falling towards the sun. And in the case of the apple on Earth, it just drops onto the ground or what have you, whereas in the case of the Earth and the sun, a sort of circular motion is set up through, you know, the difference in those two conditions. But essentially, he was saying, this is how it is, but I don't know why, but he had his mystical religious reasons for thinking so. We are still trying to get to the bottom of why things fall to Earth. So when Ben says we don't really know, he's kind of right, but it's always happened so much that if you let go of an object, it will fall to Earth.
Yeah.
Basically, it's not really correct to say I could roll something off the table and I don't think it will fall, because you're looking at what kind of object that is, and it's a fairly safe bet that all the objects that you're looking around, you know, in your room at the moment and so on, we have very solid physics about all of those objects. But, you know, why, for example, light rays or photons, as we call them, why they're not attracted by gravity, we don't yet fully understand that.
Well, it's 2019. Come on, pull your fingers out, fellas. Come on. We need to know this stuff.
Can I just point out that you didn't really, you know that a shooting star wasn't a star? So I don't think you two are the best people to start having a go at the scientific community.
Right, finally, before we let you go, this is just ridiculous, but here we go. Go on, Ben.
Okay, it's kind of along the same idea.
Ridiculous idea.
That take a wall, for example, and when you look at it, anything that is a wall or a structure of any type is built up of very condensed molecules. And similarly, human beings are also built of condensed molecules. But molecules are fluid. They move around. Just because we can't see it doesn't mean it's not happening. So technically speaking, it wouldn't be impossible for a human to be able to walk through a wall. It would just be some molecules passing through other molecules. I know it sounds ridiculous, but then again, the gravity thing sounded ridiculous.
Walk through a wall. Go on.
I can't do that.
Oh, yeah.
But it's just an idea.
Trev, I think you better engage your seatbelt.
Oh, my God. Here we
two
go.
Two in a row.
Oh, he's going to walk through walls and things will float. What are we talking about here? Go on, then.
When you speak to someone on a mobile phone, it's using exactly that principle, but obviously at a microscopic level. So if we don't talk about peoples and walls at the moment, but we talk about, if you like, an energy barrier for something as small as an electron. Yeah. Now, due to the very mysterious rules of quantum mechanics, something called barrier tunneling takes place. So an electron may appear on the other side of a barrier as if it has passed through that barrier when there's no possibility of it doing so. So that's called barrier tunneling, and modern electronics use the phenomenon of barrier tunneling all the time. The problem is when you scale up to something like human size or any bigger, how do you make that same effect occur? Well, humans aren't governed on that scale by the laws of quantum mechanics. Quantum theory only applies to the very, very tiniest of things. At human being scale, all those tiny, tiny effects kind of tend to average out. So maybe an electron of your body might be able to barrier tunnel and appear on the other side of a wall, but asking all the other particles of your body to do the same thing in a coordinated, coherent way and reconstitute you on the other side, that's asking too much. But, you know, I mean, you could sort of load yourself into a cannon and fire yourself through a wall. You would end up on the other side of it, but just not in a condition that you might want to carry on in. So again, like all these things, there is an element of truth to it, but also if you don't really understand the science behind it, it's very easy to kind of go off road and end up with a version of things that definitely isn't backed up by science.
I've seen Dynamo do it.
Yes, I'm not sure that's necessarily under scientific conditions.
Hey, look, Gareth, thank you so much for being with us on the Trev and Ben podcast. Will you come on again at some point and we'll carry on this conversation, because it's fascinating stuff, this.
I'd love to. It's really interesting talking about, you know, science at this kind of level. It's fascinating.
I'm going to just go and throw Ben at walls for the next couple of hours and just see if I can get him through.
Well, that's very similar to a lot of people's experience of trying to learn physics. So there we are.
That's almost it.
Yeah, another one in the bag.
Thanks very much to Gareth Sturdy for joining us earlier, and he'll be with us again on a future podcast. In the next edition of the Trev and Ben podcast, we'll be once again talking to Andy Drury. So last time we spoke to him, he was in Iraq.
Yes.
And he'd just completed his first day. And then he was going to go on to be smuggled into Mosul.
Yeah, it all sounded incredibly risky.
Yeah, but he is back home, but we're going to be speaking to him and find out how the rest of his trip went, so do not miss it next week. Thanks very much for listening. And if you'd like to get involved, we are on Twitter @Trev and Ben. And we'll catch you again next week. Take it easy.
Bye.